Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the City Council Chambers. How many of you have been here before? Raise your hand. All right, then you know that this is a chamber where we discuss issues, and so that means that in order for all points of view to feel comfortable being expressed, there's no noise. There's no clapping, there's no hollering, there's no hooting, there's no burping, there's no noise. If there's noise, I will have you escorted out. And if you like something, feel free to do this. If you don't like something being said, free to do that. But otherwise, we allow everyone to feel comfortable to present their point of view. The other thing, if you signed up for communications, that's great. When you beyond communications, if you wish to speak on a matter on the city council, it has to relate to the matter being discussed. And I use my discretion. If you wander too far afield from the item on the council agenda, then I will cut you off, and it's my discretion how much time I will give you. So with that, there's no talking to from the audience, period, unless you're at the mics here. Again, this is a silent chamber. Okay, Carla, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well, thank you.
Good. Can you please call the roll?
Leonard Fritz.
Good morning. Every week from now on, I'm going to be making a special announcement as well as saying that I'm here, and that is to tell everybody the new number that people should call if they're feeling suicidal or if they know somebody who's feeling suicidal. That number is 503-97-23456. 503-97-23456. Again, yesterday we had a tragedy of somebody jumping off one of the bridges, and we have help. And we want people to know that there is help available. This number will get you to Lines for Life, formerly Oregon Partnership, talking to mental health professionals and volunteers who will help folks who are in crisis work through it. So please spread the word. Here.
Fish?
Here.
Saltzman?
Here.
Adams?
Here. We'll begin with communications. Carla, can you please read the title for item number 1126?
Request of Frank Zitabel to address council regarding towing of vehicles with animals inside.
Hi, welcome. Glad you're here. You just need to give us your first and last name, and that clock will help you count down your 3 minutes.
My name is Frank Sedible. I live in Northwest, and I want to talk to you for a moment about how patrol towing affects animals left in cars. The city has a policy on this. It's an administrative policy. It provides that if an animal becomes distressed while it's in the custody of the tower, that it may be let out of the car and something could be done for it, but no one is really responsible for that. The main reliance is placed on the idea that the animal will be got out of the car after 2 hours and then handed over to animal control. But the way that this plays out at night and after hours operation is not particularly wonderful, because the animal is hauled away to a place where it really isn't supervised, except sporadically by people who are out basically paid to be elsewhere to earn a commission to find other cars to tow. And only when they come back to the lot occasionally, they might have a chance to look at the dog and see what's going on with it. Okay, so when your constituents hear about how this works at night, they're not very happy. In fact, most of them are outraged. And in a recent incident, a friend's car was towed with his dog inside at night, and I had two employees of Retriever Towing, which is our largest patrol tower, tell me that a dog could be left in the car for much longer than 2 hours. One of them said it could be left in the car for 12 hours. Another one said it could be left in the car overnight. The city towing coordinator investigated and concluded that one of the employees had misspoken. I don't think that was the answer. I don't think that was the reason why. The problem is that when you look at the towing schedule of charges, there's nothing on there that's a fee for them for taking care of a dog. There's nothing on there that's a fee for them to come back to the yard to let animal control in to get a dog out of a locked car. It's easier for them to convince the owner to come back right away and pay a $25 gate fee and get the dog out of the car. That way they have to do nothing. Okay, this is not a wonderful situation, and I think that we should do more to keep animals out of this system because we can't apparently control it adequately. I have no idea when those guys would have let the dog out of the car. Nobody else has any idea here either. Now, if you look at the schedule of charges, you'll find near the top of the page that the vehicle operator is paying for 30 minutes of labor on site. My proposal is that the tower should be required to wait at least 30 minutes for the owner to return and get the animal before the vehicle is towed. He's paying for that time. We should give it to him and to his animal. Thanks very much.
Thanks for your testimony. Can you please read the title for item number 1127?
Request of Charlie White to address council regarding dosage of water fluoridation.
Are you Charlie?
Yes, I am.
Welcome.
Thank you. Portland City Council members, thank you for allowing me to be here. Your plan is
can you move the mic a little closer so we can hear
sure,
you?
Sure, thank you. Your plan is to put
Just repeat your name, please.
Okay, Charlie White. I'm a Portland resident. Your plan is to put 0.7 parts per million of toxic fluoride compounds in our water, thereby dosing the water. While 2 years ago that was considered the optimal dose of one part per million, was lowered to a new optimal dose of 0.7 parts per million. When will you take seriously the FDA's non-approved fluoride and see there is no such thing as an optimal dose of fluoride ingestion? Furthermore, you are dosing the water while you are in no way monitoring the dose that individuals receive. How do you rectify this? I find it unconscionable. What gives you the right to dose us as if we are a smear of people? How do you justify this dose for infants? Will you give infant warnings to caregivers? If not, you are adversely affecting the long-term health of these developing little bodies who are dependent on us to make healthy choices for them. How do you justify this dose for the increasing chemically sensitive population? How does one detox with toxified water? What of the skin, our largest organ? How do you justify this dose for people who drink large amounts of water, such as athletes, construction workers, active children? What of kidney dialysis patients, cancer patients, those with thyroid and other endocrine system difficulties, the elderly who, due to their age, have simply accumulated toxins? Are you intending to test as a baseline the existing fluoride levels of children currently, many exhibiting already excessive amounts of fluoride by way of dental fluorosis? If not, why not? And if not, is it conscionable to be exposing them to more of an unapproved drug? How are you going to address other already fluoridated areas such as TVWD, and how do you intend to accommodate these systems? How do you know the dose is consistent all along the line? People who already use fluoridated toothpaste and mouthwashes, typical, they're topical, and they're a choice because people like me choose not to use them. Once you put these toxic compounds into our water, how do you know they won't be getting too much fluoride? With the exception of Amanda and Dan, why is the City Council so unwilling to hear from us and give equal time to the many of us who know much more about this issue than the supposed experts and professionals you courted and who benefit from the use and sale of fluoride? Water fluoridation is big business. Private-public partnerships, moving money around, lobbyists, special treatment for special interests are all marketing and promotion schemes that push these policies through city after city relentlessly, and now Portland. Our cultural mindset has been heavily and effectively promoted by the dental groups for over 60 years and at great expense of our time, our dollars, and most concerning, our health. Gathering signatures has proven to be successful because whether or not the great people of Portland want fluoride toxins in their water,
and
they especially don't like not having a greater voice in a supposed representative government.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can you please read the item number 1128?
Request of Fernando Solis to address council regarding October National Homeless Day.
Welcome. Just have a seat. And you just need to give us your first and last name.
Yes, sir. My name is Fernando Antonio Solis. Good morning, Mayor, Commissioners, I'm sorry. The message I have for you guys is that Right to Dream 2 does work. It works in many, many ways. Too many to explain to you in these 3 minutes. The way it has worked for myself and my significant other is it has brought us out from the cold, from the street. And I tell you this sincerely. I don't like speaking much. I don't like telling people what this place has really done. But this place does work. And I want you guys to understand that. I want you guys to know that the fines you guys are imposing on R2D2 are unfair, are wrong. I mean, this place does work. It works. It's getting people out of the cold. It's getting people out of the street. And that's all I have for you.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your testimony. Can you please read the title for item number 1129?
Request of Amber Dunks to address council regarding Right to Dream 2.
Hi, welcome. You just need to give us your first and last name.
My name is Amber Dunks. At last count, there were 1,700 homeless people on the streets of Portland, Oregon. There's only a few hundred shelter beds to go around. And there's just not enough shelter. And Dignity Village is the first example that works of the, of a low to no, a no cost, low cost, affordable solution for people to be able to go to. They've been there for 12 years. They've proven that they work. Right to Dream 2 has been there since October 10th of last year. Today is our first, is our 1 year anniversary. A lot of people thought that we wouldn't last the month. We've exceeded their expectations. We've lasted a year now with no help from, with no financial help from the city. We do our own security. We actually have provided thousands of nights to houseless individuals out on the sleep, out on the streets of safe sleep. What I see as the problem is I hear all this talk about solutions for ending houselessness. There is really only one solution for ending houselessness, and that is affordable housing. And until that happens, we need those temporary and transitional solutions like Dignity Village and Right to Dream 2. They work. Give us a chance as houseless people, because we are houseless people helping other houseless people. Give us that chance to prove that we can help ourselves. Today is World Homeless Action Day. What I would like to do is I would like to issue a call to action for the City of Portland and the City Council to work with us and not against us. I would like to think that we all have the same goal, which is ending homelessness. And I would just like City Council to work with us to find those solutions, because we've been there. We're there. We're struggling with this every single day. We know what we need. Just give us the chance to let you know what we need.
Thank you for your
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it. No clapping. No noise. That's why we're doing the hands. I'm happy to have you removed, Mr. Walsh. Carly, can you please read the item 1130?
Request of Mark Hubble to address council regarding homeless issues.
Welcome. Glad you're here.
Good morning.
Please have a seat. All you need to do is give us your first and last name for the record.
Mark Hubble. I am a proud citizen and proud member of R2D2. I want to thank you for your time. I didn't have a speech prepared, so I'm just going to talk, and we'll see how this goes. Ladies and gentlemen, you know homelessness is, you know, this is a social event. This is something that's going on around the world right now. We need to address. It is also a very individual event, as it affects over 1,700 in Portland itself and around the world. I've met these people on the street, and they really are very caring and very substantial people. They have a lot to offer. Society will not see it this way and does not see it this way. We are termed invisible. We've been made to be invisible. And this is an absolute injustice against our, not only our universal, but our constitutional right. These folks have, a lot to offer. I go out on outreaches every week, and I see these people. I look them in the eye. I ask them how they're doing. And we talk about what we can do for them, the services that we can provide. And they're very simple. So help us get in touch with the job market. Help us get in touch with social services. Help us get a blanket, a little bit of food. You know, where can we go for this type of thing? These folks are affected by the cuts in social services drastically. These folks are affected by the lack of transportation. The max now, the free zone is now cut. So they have to pick and choose where they go and what they do every day, what's most important for them. We have to think outside the box, take off the glasses, and look at these folks for what they really are, individuals that can help, that are willing to help. They have strengths that can be used in this society, and they do want to get better. They're very aware of what they look like and who they are. I would just like to, come up with alternatives, work with us. This is a good alternative, I'm telling you right now. Help me to help you to help them.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your testimony. Carla, that gets us to the consent agenda. Have there been any items pulled from consent?
First, I request to pull 1137, and also we've had requests for 1136, 39, 40, 43, and 44.
Okay, can you? Yeah, you let us fast. Can you say the number? Or you're just going to read the titles, if you would.
I will. 1136, authorize a grant with Outside In an amount not to exceed $65,000 to operate the Injection Drug Users Health Services Program. And 1137 was requested by your office. Set a hearing date, 9:30 a.m. Wednesday, November 14th, 2012, to vacate a portion of Southwest Moody Drive north of Ross Island Bridge. And 1139, grant a right-of-way use agreement to Clear Wireless LLC for 3 years for wireless broadband internet access services and establish terms and conditions. 1140, grant a right-of-way use agreement to Sprint Spectrum LP for 3 years for mobile telecommunication services and establish terms and conditions. 1143, authorize intergovernmental agreement between the Portland Housing Bureau and Multnomah County Health Department, Environmental Health Services Department, to support healthy homes activities. 1144, authorize a subrecipient contract with Reach Community Development for $583,146 to provide for healthy homes program remediation.
Carla, who pulled 43 and 44?
Mike D. Mike Me? D. A citizen Mike D.
Okay.
All right. Let's see. 1139 and 1140 actually are going to be carried over till next week.
Actually, those are going to be continued to November 4th, their charter requirements.
So the title has been read unless there are objections. 1139 is carried forward to November 7th.
Yes.
All right. And as well with 1140. No objections. So done. And that gets us to a vote. Anybody else pull any items from the consent agenda? All right. Can you please call the vote on the consent agenda?
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. Consent agenda is approved. That gets us to time certain, item number 1131.
Assess benefited properties for water main improvements in the Delta Wood Phase 1 Local Improvement District. Did you want to also read 1132? 1132, assess benefited properties for sanitary sewer improvements in the Delta Wood Phase 2 Local Improvement District.
Mr. Abbey, welcome back. How are you?
Very well, Mayor Adam. Thank you.
What are we looking at? You push the button.
There we go. Thank you. Good morning, Mayor Adams. Joining me on my far left is Dan Ward from the Portland Water Bureau. He was the contract manager on the Delta Wood project for construction. And then we have Chris Collette from the Bureau of Environmental Services, and we have Cindy Dietz from the Portland Water Bureau. I'd like to walk you through a brief presentation here. So just to reorient council to the location of this project, the Delta Wood community is located in Northeast Portland, as shown on the map here in the presentation. When we started discussing an LID, this was kind of an orphan community. It wasn't part of a neighborhood association. Around the time we formed the LID, it became part of the East Columbia Neighborhood Association. I think council knows that there were some severe deficiencies with water and sewer infrastructure. We worked with the property owners and the homeowners association to form two LIDs to rebuild the private water system and private sewer system. The community received an award last year, a statewide award for building a better community, and that award was granted by the Oregon chapter of the Community Associations Institute. So just recapping where we were at on this LID, there are 41 developed lots in the neighborhood, of which one is vacant. It appears that about 60% of those have turned over since LID formation. So we have a lot of new property owners in the LID, and we have owners of two properties with us today. I believe both of those are among those property owners who purchased since the LID was formed. So in terms of the objectives of these two LIDs, before the LID was formed, there was one water meter for the entire community. So the utility billing was made via a single bill to the Homeowners Association, which the Homeowners Association then went and split the bill up among all the property owners living in the community. A problem with that is that we were not able to offer low-income discounts because people were not on individual meters. More importantly, the private system had major leaks, and the sewer system was leaking as well. You may recall we had some testimony at LID formation that a gentleman had just purchased his home and he was finding sewage leaks in his front yard shortly after he moved in. And over and above that, we also wanted to help the property owners eliminate the chronic and ongoing repairs to the private utilities. And I want to just pass this around, but this is a part of the old water system. So this is what was excavated out. This is the pipe through which 41 homes were being served in Delta Wood.
41 homes were served on that pipe?
On that pipe.
The smallest water main I think we've ever
And finally, there was a back bill when we formed the LID. Unfortunately, there is one. It declined slightly when you take into account a $44,000 credit, but as of August, it was down to $61,000. So a key objective of this LID was to get everybody on individual meters, but everybody in charge of their own bill so that people could pay their own bill and we could stop the increase in the back utility bill. And my final slide is really just to lay out for you the business case for why we did the LID. When we formed the LID, we had an average per property LID assessment of about $19,000 per property. That has since decreased to $16,410. So right off the top, everybody is saving a little over $2,500 for both LIDs combined. That savings on their assessment, combined with the reduction in the interim financing rate, has resulted in a decrease of what people would pay per month if they elect for the 20-year financing. So we estimated that at LID formation at $152 a month. That would now be $120 a month. The other thing I would point out to council is when we formed the LID, we were not going to offer an LID deferral. Council passed an ordinance on the consent agenda earlier this year where we are now offering a deferral. So if council approves these assessments next week and folks have applied for the low-income deferral, they will not have to begin paying on their LID assessments right away because the deferral will take care of them, and they can get that deferral for 5 years and then reapply after 5 years. And then this is what I found very striking. We went and looked at the water usage records for the community, and we compared 2009, where we had the highest leakage going on in the neighborhood, and then we took a snapshot view earlier this year, and we found that the average daily usage had declined from 0.39 100 cubic feet down to 0.15. So it had dropped by more than half. Now, in terms of what people can expect to pay moving forward on their utility bill, some people will pay more and some people will pay less. But if you just simply use that example in terms of moving forward, what the impact would be on the water bill, if you look at those highlighted numbers over on the right, if folks do not qualify for the low-income discount, they could expect to see somewhere in the neighborhood of an $81 per month reduction in their ongoing utility bill. If, however, they qualify for the low-income discount, which we expect many people will, then their saving would be somewhere in the neighborhood of $121 a month. So if you just simply do the math here, you can see that the LID essentially would pay for itself, especially if they qualify for the low-income discount. So that's all I had to share with you today. I'm happy to answer any questions, and I've got Bureau staff here as well.
Questions from council?
So are we going to talk about the BES portion of this as well?
Yeah, actually, the numbers I just gave you, Commissioner, were for both water and BES combined. Okay. So.
All right. Would anyone, and you're here to testify on both items, right? This covers both items.
Yes.
Okay. Is anyone here that wishes to testify? Thank you very much for your great work on this. We really appreciate it. Thank you for your participation in this as well. We really appreciate it. That's one small pipe for a lot of people. Anyone wish to testify on this matter?
We have three people who signed up.
Please come forward.
Christine Herman, Lindy Nicola, and Craig D. Cummings.
Welcome. Would you like to begin, sir?
Certainly. My name's Craig Cummings. I live at 9527 Northeast Gertz Circle, and I am a resident in Snoozy's Hollow. Basically, that pipe is part of a pipe that came out of my front lawn. I have another bigger 2-foot-long section where a foot and a half, roughly, of it had zippered open and was no longer usable. That essentially resulted in my entire subfloor being flooded for about 2 days. So basically, we were like your next-door neighbor that was running his sprinkler 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and the water was going out in the street. Totally irresponsible. I really appreciate you authorizing this particular upgrade. So now we have a neighborhood that is livable and sustainable. Thank you.
Thanks for your participation. Hi, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Mayor Adams and City Commissioners. My name is Christine Herman, and I'm a property owner in the Delta Wood community. I'm here today to tell you about the residents of Delta Wood. Number two, to describe why the assessments are a substantial burden that will exacerbate the neighborhood's foreclosure problem. And three, to respectfully ask you to defer making a decision until you have visited the neighborhood and heard firsthand their concerns about how this decision will affect them personally and as a community. Andrew Abey talked to you a little bit about, described Delta Wood. There are 41 extremely modest small homes, 90% of them. They're 2-bedroom, 1-bath, 620 to 740 square feet. They're located approximately a half mile north of Columbia Boulevard and east of MLK. You wouldn't know they're there. They're hidden away. They're surrounded the Jubitz truck stop, A weekly motel, a large trailer court, and a number of trucking and light industrial uses are surrounding these 41 homes, which you wouldn't see unless you drove off MLK. The majority of the homes, I looked at all the ownerships, are owner-occupied. I've personally met many of the neighbors and asked them what they did. A number of are on fixed incomes, or they are employed in lower-wage jobs, in retail, service sector, landscaping, and one in the trucking industry. I looked at RMLS data for sales in the neighborhood. There were 6 homes sold in the neighborhood in the last 2 years, and the average sales price was shockingly under $40,000. No homes have been sold in the last year in that neighborhood. This compares to an average price of $240,000. It's the median sales price on the latest RMLS sales in Portland. I met several of the homeowners in Deltawood and talked to them about the pending assessments and the impact that it will have on their lives. Although I encouraged my Deltawood neighbors to come today to tell you their stories in person, they all declined because, number one, some of them have jobs that preclude them from talking to you in person. The next door neighbor is disabled and is unable to come. Cake was unable to come. They also have life experiences, I think, that preclude them from proactively being able to advocate for themselves. And they're not politically sophisticated people. They said, I don't know, I can't go downtown and testify in front of city council. But I do want to update you on Vito Mercado. He was the one homeowner who lives at 9401 Northeast Skirts Court who did provide a written remonstrance to the city auditor in January 2009 to object to the proposed Deltawood Phase 1 LID. I have a picture of Victor's home. I don't know if I'm allowed to introduce
pictures. Sure. You can give it to Carl. She'll pass it to us.
Oh, I have pictures. I have his listing, and I have the letter that he wrote, just because pictures tell 1,000 words about, I think, about what this. So Victor claimed in his letter that was a hardship. He had 6 children. He was unable, and this was in 2009, Mr. Mercado was unable to keep up with his mortgage payment and the HOA dues, which a couple years ago were over $200 on top of the mortgage, they were so high because of the amount that the HOA owes the city. It was $100,000. I appreciate the fact that the city reduced it by $44,000, but there's still $61,000 owed. The dues are currently less than $200, but it's still, because I think they're not paying, the homeowners are not paying, have not setting aside money to repay the city that debt. So for over a year, Mr. Mercado tried to sell that house, and I've given you the RMLS for $45,000. That home was unable to be sold this year, and he is now in default. He has moved, and that home is vacant. There's at least one other home in foreclosure in that neighborhood. I did the research I went and looked at every ownership. Since 2008, 12 of these 41 homes have been foreclosed on. That's a 29% foreclosure rate. It's important, I think, for the City Council to understand that the Phase 1 and Phase 2 liens are not the only hardship the city is imposing on these very predominantly very low-income home owners. It's a triple burden. Number one, the liens. I understand that's a maximum of $16,500, and I do appreciate the fact that that the city has reduced it from over a $20,000 maximum. Sewer, the homeowners must also connect to the city sewer within a very short period of time. And my discussions with city staff estimate that these are likely to range from $3,000 to $10,000. They also, as I said before, the HOA owes the city $61,000, which these homeowners must repay. I appreciate the fact that you have the safety net program, and I think that's great, and that safety net program may defer payments for those that qualify. But and still, even for those that qualify, the principal and interest is accruing, which wipes out any equity that any of these homeowners may have. And then there are homeowners that may not qualify for the safety net, and the additional payments will be a hardship for struggling homeowners that may cause them to default. I know one person was saying, when I appreciate the city came to help people fill out that neighborhood meeting to help them fill out the safety net. One person was saying, I might have to sell my truck. I don't know how I'm going to pay for this. So for all the homeowners in GERT, if the homeowner has any equity, the city will be taking all or a large portion of the equity from struggling homeowners whose home is likely to be their only asset. Please consider my request to defer your action today and get to know the residents of this unique community before you decide to pose an assessment, which will likely wipe out any equity if any of them have it in their homes.
thank you very much for your time and consideration of my request.
Thanks for your testimony. I really appreciate it. Hi, welcome.
Well, hi. Good morning, Mayor, and good morning, Commissioners. My name is Lindy Lou Nicola, and I'm a property owner as well. And I think Christine summed it up really basically by saying these people can't afford, even if it's deferred, will never be able to afford to pay that kind of assessment. Yes, I do think the system was needed. And, you know, much like he said, it's to benefit the neighborhood. But I think that if you don't understand the neighborhood and the homeowners over there, it's, for instance, I think you received a letter from Vivian Rizak on October 3rd. And basically she's stating, you know, the assessments are going to run roughly $16,000, and then along with maybe the hookup charges that they're also going to be responsible for. And according to city staff, it said they were prepared to have loans for maybe from $3,000 to $10,000 for the hookup. So, and just to reiterate, on the attachment, she shows the six homes and what they were sold for in the past 2 years. It was $50,000, $49,500, $40,000, $36,900, $31,000, and $29,500. And it sort of shows you by the time they do their assessments, if these people do sell their home, they will have no equity whatsoever. And I think if you have not really gone into the neighborhood yourself and seen it, it's really sort of a very different, very unique little community that's nestled among industry. So the homes are no longer worth what these people paid for. Like in 2007, there were a lot of homes that went for like from $100,000 to $150,000. And just to show you how much they have decreased in value. So while we're saying that, yes, we think the system was needed, it's that these people are not going to be able to really pay for these, even if it's deferred. Unfortunately, some of the less sophisticated people felt like the deferral meant they would never have to pay. So we would really, more than anything, ask that before you decide to assess this part of town, that you at least go out and make a more decisive, choice by talking to the people and realizing that these people will never be able to pay that kind of money. If they do, they'll have to walk away from their homes. They won't have a choice. So actually what we're asking is just defer it and maybe do a further study of what the people are going to be able to do.
So, thank you for your testimony. Yep.
Was it Haynes? Chris, what was your last name?
Oh, Herman.
Herman, Ms. Herman and
yes.
Ms. McCullough. I guess, you know, I appreciate all of your testimony very much, and it's very compelling. But given sort of the infrastructure deficiencies in Deltawood, isn't it going to enhance property values if the sewers and water service are adequate and not leaking? I mean,
oh, we don't contest the fact that it will benefit the little area. It's just that people can't afford to pay the assessments. You know, if they walk away, they just have no equity left in their home. If they pay it, they will have no equity left in their home.
So you're suggesting that we just don't do these improvements? Is that, I don't want to put words in your mouth, I'm just asking. Is
that, can I answer that question? No, I'm not suggesting that you don't do the improvements. Uh-huh. I mean, it's great. No, I think that's great, the improvements where they needed to be done. You can't have 41 homes on common with leaking pipes. I think that's great that you did it. And to answer your question on the property values are determined by comparable sales in the neighborhood. No sales in the last year. Two homes have gone, you can't sell those homes because of the HOA. What's also because of the HOA dues are high, and people realize that they owe the city $61,000. They might go up to $200. They have this assessment, you know, that's going to increase. It's a combination of your values in that neighborhood are about $40,000. That's what they are. That's the last sales. The six sales average about $40,000 to $50,000.
And we don't ask to defer the program. I mean, the program is basically done except for the hookups. That's all that's left in the program. And like the city said, maybe $3,000 to $10,000 for each person to have to pay the hookup for their home. After they redid the street, I had to spend a pretty large amount of money to do a French drain because they didn't put the street back like it was, and because things tend to flood there because they're in a pocket. So we had to do a French drain and a more extensive draining system, because it's still flooding. There's one house that stays flooded. And it's not going to, you know, I don't know what they're going to do. You know which house I'm talking about at the very end.
I think you're saying
there is no drainage.
So you're saying you support the improvements, but figure out a way to make it less of a burden on the.
Yes. Yeah. Oh no. Yes, we're not denying that this was a great improvement needed. It's just that the assessments that are going to be put upon these homeowners are going to be so excessive that it's. I'm afraid there's going to be a lot of people who are going to have to walk away from their home.
Thank you all very much. Appreciate it. Anyone else wish to testify in this matter? Council, questions of staff? Follow-up with staff?
This is a first reading.
Yep. Yeah. I just want to make sure. All right.
Well, I guess, yep. Yeah. Andrew, why don't you come up here? I know LIDs are kind of a strange duck. There's a BES LID, Bureau of Environmental Services, sewer LID. Is this something I can return to my office, the BES portion? And
sure.
I'd like to sort of revisit some of the issues in light of this testimony. And
sure.
I know you do a great job, but I also am hearing some heartfelt testimony, too.
Sure. Commissioner, the council has the full discretion to put off imposing the assessments. I guess I was a little confused hearing the testimony because, again, we are planning to offer a deferral. So if the folk apply for the deferral, and I can have Chris Collette come up and speak to this in further detail, but if there are folks that still want to apply for the deferral, I think it would be BES's intent to continue working with property owners to grant that deferral. So in theory, if you impose the assessments next week and the deferrals are offered, there's no cash out of pocket for the LID. I think one thing that would be worth pointing out is that we really have two separate issues here. We have the LID issue, and then we have the HOA issue, which is related to that utility bill. The huge utility bill, the back bill, the delinquency on it, that all predated the LID. The LID did not change that. The LID basically just stopped the bleeding so that the bill wouldn't continue to increase as a result of ongoing charges. So I appreciate that could be a deterrent to people purchasing homes in the neighborhood. At some point, with all the ongoing charges now being individually metered, that will become less of an issue over time. So that really is a completely separate issue from the LID, and the action that you're weighing here today will have no effect on whatever issues.
Okay, I guess, I appreciate this. I guess what I'm hearing, there's a lot of people living on the margin these days in the city, and people in Delta Woods seem to be, below the margin, if not living on the margin.
Sure.
I guess I would like some more time to sort through this than next week. So if you could maybe set it over a couple weeks or something like that.
There are two ordinances.
Yeah.
One water, one.
So I guess I'm asking the BES one at least.
And I would just, given that I have the companion ordinance, I think I would expand on the question you asked of the witnesses. And this isn't so much a question for Andrew, but I am familiar with the real estate market right now, and I would think that anybody that was interested in a house in Deltawood would be spooked by the lack of water and sewer service, maybe even more than the HOA liability, and that these properties now will have city water and sewer service should not be underestimated in terms of raising the value of the properties that these folks are concerned about. So I absolutely agree. We ought to do everything we can to make it as easy as we can, but I think we have done that. I've been satisfied that the Water Bureau has. If you're not satisfied, BES hasn't. Certainly, it's your right to take that back, but I think we have provided a program and we've replaced a really dysfunctional system administratively and physically, and I think folks that have undervalued properties will now find that they'll more than recoup that investment, particularly with the deferral that these properties, as has been pointed out, and I have been to Deltawood. I used to work in that area, and there's a lot that people might like in that area as well. It's a very unique area and has some natural beauty in and around it. So I would think now that we've corrected these issues that they'll more than make up what the cost was in improving the equity of their homes.
So, Commissioner, do you want to send it back to your office or just 2 weeks out?
2 weeks out.
Okay. Yeah. And you're fine with it just going next week or 2 weeks? Next week.
I think just move it next week.
Okay. So unless there are objections, that 1131, we'll just continue it for council consideration next week. And 1132 is set over to November, December,
October. 24th.
October 24th. So done. Can you please read the title for item number 1133?
Accept plastic bag ban, 1 year report.
Oregonians use an estimated 1.7 billion single-use plastic bags each year, the equivalent of 444 bags for every man, woman, and child in the state every year. Plastic bags contaminate our waterways and storm drains, damaging marine systems. They jam up our recycling facility machines and cost thousands of dollars in maintenance and repair. That's why last July, the City Council approved a ordinance to prohibit the largest generators of single-use plastic bags, checkout bags, large grocery stores, large retailers that have pharmacies from distributing these bags. Today, part of that ordinance also required that we come back for a year review. That's what the report is today. And my intention is to take the report today, take testimony, and then come back in November with next steps, which was also alluded to in the first ordinance. So I'd like to introduce our fantastic director of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability to take us through some of the details, Susan Anderson. Director Anderson.
Thank you. Good morning. Susan Anderson, Director of Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. It's been about a year since we adopted the ordinance and the policy to both promote reusable shopping bags and also to reduce the use of plastic shopping bags. So you all adopted the ordinance in July, and it went into effect on October 15th of last year. After Council adopted the ordinance, we worked with 167 different grocery stores and pharmacies that were affected by the ordinance. Grocery stores were ones with gross annual sales of $2 million or more, and large retailers with more than 10,000 square feet that also have pharmacies. So those are the groups that were affected. Again, the reason that we did this was to reduce the number of plastic bags that are going to the landfill, that are out blowing around in the wind, and that gum up our recycling facility equipment. And second, also to encourage the use of reusable bags instead of disposables. So to that end, over the past year, we worked with stores to encourage them to offer for sale reusable bags, and we provided reusable bags and educational materials for low-income families and for seniors. We worked with Elders in Action, Loaves and Fishes, the Oregon Food Bank, and several other organizations to distribute reusable bags and provide information in five different languages. So we've had the program for a year, and so I thought I'd come back and report on how it's working. First of all, we found that since implementing the program, and this was only during the first 2 weeks, we had four complaints that said people were still using handing out plastic bags. We went to those stores. Since then, everybody's in compliance at all 167 stores, and we've had no other complaints. A second finding is that reusable checkout bag use went up. So people are bringing their bags. They're remembering. They're doing it more and more. But a third finding is that paper checkout bags have also increased dramatically. So while many people have shifted from plastic to reusable, many other people have also shifted from just using plastic to using a paper bag. So the bottom line is we've eliminated single-use bags at 167 stores. We've increased the number of Portlanders that are using reusable bags, but we've also increased the number of paper checkout bags. And while they are made from recycled paper and most of them then are recycled or composted later, it still would be better to get more people to use reusable bags. As part of the report, we also looked all around the country. There's 20 or 30 other cities that have banned, or maybe more, plastic bags. We focused on West Coast cities, Corvallis, Eugene, LA, San Francisco, Santa Cruz, and Seattle, to see how they were addressing this issue of increased paper bag use. And what we found was, first of all, that some of the cities have expanded their ordinance to kind of go beyond just the grocery stores, and several of them have gone kind of to all retailers. So that's been an expanded program. And then also to reduce the number of paper bags being used, they are beginning to charge for those bags, either 5 cents or 10 cents, depending on the city. The charge provides a very clear price signal that people can save money if they bring their own bag. What it doesn't really tell you is that you're already paying for the bag. It's hidden in the cost along with labor and the electricity bill and everything else to run the store. And so it's not a new fee. You're already paying for it. It just pulls it out separate so that people can kind of make a decision there whether they want to make and whether they want to pay for that part of the service. So if you want to think about next steps, we really have three options. The first is kind of keep the status quo. Just maintain the bag ban as it is and have us work hard to expand marketing efforts to encourage reusable bags. The second option is to expand the current policy to include all or most retailers because there are still millions of plastic bags out blowing in the wind or ending up in the garbage or ending up in the recycling that then causes the recycling equipment to have problems, a lot of problems. Again, one caution with just expanding the program is that that means a lot of people will just shift to paper bags, and unless we have some kind of a huge campaign around reusable bags. So I think just broadening it to all without having some kind of fee will end up just shifting from plastic to paper.
So can I ask you about that point?
Mm-hmm.
Because as I understood this issue when it came before us originally, we had legitimate concerns. I certainly had concerns, I think, based on empirical data, that once plastic bags get into the environment, they stay in the environment.
Mm-hmm.
They may end up in wildlife, they may end up in landfills, but they're there forever. This feels like you're shifting the focus to include paper bags as part of a problem, and I never understood paper bags to be a problem. And I'm concerned about calling out a mandatory 5 cent cost or 10 cent cost for paper bags.
Okay.
Maybe you can help me understand
sure.
why all of a sudden we have grouped paper bags along with plastic bags as part of a problem. And if it is a problem, why is it a problem?
Well, if I could just follow up on that, you mentioned that like electricity, labor, paper bags are part of the cost of doing business.
Right.
What's wrong with that? Why shouldn't the retailers bear the cost of the paper bags?
Okay, so this is why I want to
declare victory that reusable bags are up 300%.
Say that again.
Why don't we just declare victory that after 1 year, reusable bags are up 300% and plastic bags are banned?
Well, you can get to that question, but I want to first understand why all of a sudden paper bags have become synonymous with plastic bags as a problem. I don't understand.
So all along, that was not the only problem. The issue is plastic bags have this other problem, which is dealing with the environment and being in wildlife issues predominantly. Both paper and plastic bags, when they do, you know, you'll see those side-by-side comparisons, you know, use lots of energy. They're you know, it's an unnecessary item in terms of potentially. Some and many probably in the audience look as paper bags are also unnecessary because they're paper and resources to make those when you could use a reusable bag, which would save trees and energy and water in the production of those bags.
That's an entirely different argument than what we had a year ago.
I think several people probably here and elsewhere.
I mean, from the proponents of our ordinance that we passed, we were focused on eliminating plastic bags. And now the argument seems to have expanded to include the villainous paper bags.
I feel like we made both of those arguments from the beginning, but I'm happy to continue to have the conversation. So really, I mean, and I think this is why we're bringing it forward, is to say, do you want to keep it as it is? Do more marketing and propose to focus on reusable bags? Or do you want to give people a clear price signal that we want to shift towards reusable bags more broadly? And so those are the three options. Seattle, San Francisco, LA County, the entire county has shifted to the 5 cent fee because they're looking at it as a way to broaden for both of those issues, both looking at wildlife issues, but also looking at energy, water, tree resources going into paper bags. So we're gonna look at options with stakeholders, with the grocers, with the public over the next month or so, and we'll come back to you and have that discussion then.
Okay, I guess I'll pursue my line of questioning. So paper bags don't clog recycling machinery. Paper bags have a heavy recycled content, over 30% at least in Portland.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Paper bags are by and large manufactured, employing people in the Pacific Northwest. Okay, just wanted to help that.
Yeah.
So do you think this is a good time to be taxing people's food when hunger is at record levels? I mean, a 5-cent, 10-cent bag fee is a tax on food.
Well, I'd love to do this a little bit one-on-one to break out all the costs of bringing you your groceries. You already pay for the bag.
Right,
this is just pulling it out. And so, you could have long discussions about whether the grocers are going to then reduce their costs on all of their products by their certain amount, because the cost of their bags are going down, and they're getting this additional revenue, just like you could for any of the other inputs that go into the grocery store. So, yes, it is by pulling that fee out and making it very visible, it's giving the consumer a choice about whether they spend it or not.
I guess if you look at the fact, again, it's people, as we just heard in the previous testimony, mm-hmm. on the Deltawood community, there's a lot of people living on the margin or below the margin. I would say the low-income population of Portland probably exceeds the population of Corvallis and Eugene combined.
And LA
County. I don't think we're talking about adequately considering impacts of a tax on food on mm-hmm. low-income individuals.
Right.
Noble as the cause may be, it's an embedded cost. Why not leave it as an embedded cost? We've increased reusable bags 300%. We've banned plastic bags. Why do we need to do this at this time?
Commissioner, what's before us today is a report on what we've accomplished in the past year and a report on what other communities have done. So your conversation is, and the discussion is totally appropriate. That's what we're doing. But I feel behind your comments that some decision has been made, and we're the ones that make that decision, not somebody else. So the conversation, the reason to bring this forward is to have the conversation, what we've accomplished, what other cities have done, and the three options the director's made very clear are on the table. There could be hybrids, there could be others. That's the reason to have this public conversation. I would also just like to say that I was very clear, we were very clear, that both paper and plastic have impacts on the environment. They're different impacts on the environment. The fact that we have local manufacturers and high recycling of paper bags here is something we talked about and is something that we need to keep on the table as we look at next steps.
And I would just say part of the reason I supported the plastic ban, and I said so at the time, was paper employs people locally, paper bags. So that was part of my decision-making matrix. So I guess I want to take this opportunity to say that I don't believe it's a good time to be taxing food, period. And you can call it what you want, but that's what it is. So I am taking this opportunity to say I am unequivocally opposed to any kind of a paper bag fee. You know, when I look at retailers like Target that made net income of almost $3 billion, Kroger net income $600 million, as far as I'm concerned, I am not sympathetic to the incurred cost of paper bags to them. They should just treat it like a cost of doing business. It's a cost of serving customers. Customer convenience is a lot of what marketing is all about in the grocery business. So I guess I'll...
Thanks for your comments. I'd like to open it up to public testimony unless there's additional discussion with counsel and the director. All right, Carla, can you please call up folks that signed up to testify?
We have four people signed up. Please come on up. Mike D., Joe Gilliam, Jessica Miller, and Rob Cochran.
All right, please come up. You just need to give us your first and last name. If you are a lobbyist, you need to disclose who you're a lobbyist for. Hi, welcome. Who'd like to begin? Mr. Gilliam?
Sure. Mr. Mayor, members of the council, my name is Joe Gilliam. I represent the Northwest Grocery Association. There are 55 stores who are members of mine in the city of Portland who are affected by the ban. You have most of the stats, I think, that are in your report. These are strictly from grocery. Thank you very much. These are strictly from grocery. There are many of the stats you've already heard, so I don't need to drag you through the numbers again. I think you've seen those numbers. I'll be happy to answer questions about that. And maybe my time would best be served to answer questions on paper, plastic, grocery, profit margins, cost of business, and those types of things.